All right, Kim Gordon, thanks very much. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, 11 minutes after 12. Told you that Ian Scher will be along from CNET a little bit later in the program. Also, we'll talk to Scott Magnuson, Managing Director, Financial Advisor with Morgan Stanley out in Oak Brook, about creating some emergency fun pot, you know, put your money away for in case you need it. That's one of the things we'll probably talk to Terry Savage about as well, putting money away for a down payment on a house. But I want to start on Wall Street. Terry Savage on a phone line now. Terry, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Always glad to be here with you on Wednesdays.
We'll go house shopping a little bit later, but let's start on Wall Street. The Dow now is down, I think, about 56 points or so. It was down 70 not too long ago. And Steve Alexander said in the Business Report, among other things, they're looking at worries around the world. Now, you had Rex Tillerson with an unscheduled or at least unannounced meeting with President Putin that was earlier today, if it's not still ongoing. So we've got that. We've got the situation in North Korea, and a lot for investors to be worried about.
You would think they would be even more worried. I mean, in my lifetime, the idea of a face-off with Russia and a face-off with North Korea armed with nuclear missiles would be enough to send the stock market into a tailspin. I don't know whether we've all gotten bored or blasé about it, but it's, to me, almost shocking that we're sending ships over into North Korea, you know, area, and that we are having a market only down 50.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, is it that we just now are not hyper-reacting to everything, or if there's just so much there's so much going on that it's hard to keep track of any one thing?
It absolutely is, or maybe we are so inured with 24-hour and instantaneous news that we our panic levels don't rise anymore. Well, whatever it is, it's interesting that the market is pretty calm, except, you know, you see it in two places, or three. You see it in treasuries. People are from around the world are putting their money looking for safety, so they're buying U.S. treasuries. So the 10-year yield, the one on which mortgage rates are based, now has dropped back to below 2.3%. It was over 2.5% at the beginning of, oh, my goodness, Trump's going to spend all this money. The economy's going to rev up. It was close to 2.75%. So it's backed off. The Japanese yen has suddenly become a safe place. I don't know why. They're a closer target to Korea. But the other, of course, is gold.
Yeah, and you've been talking about gold in recent weeks. I know earlier today it hit a five-month high. It settled down a little bit since then. But are there still ways to get into gold, or what's your advice when it comes to gold?
Yeah, you know, I've personally always been a gold bug, so I always own gold in a variety of forms. But even for people who aren't concerned about having a hedge against all their other bets, a place where money runs to hide in times of uncertainty, it's a good idea to have a small portion of your assets in gold, and you can either do it. I don't think anybody's running around buying gold bars, storing them. That's not the way to go. Gold coins are wonderful. You pay a little bit of a charge for the minting costs, and then you have to pay a fee for a safe deposit box to store them. And probably the easiest way to buy gold is through stocks, individual stocks or mutual funds that buy gold companies, and almost every major no-load company has a gold shares mutual fund, Fidelity, Vanguard, U.S. Global Investors is probably one of the better known gold funds, and American Century Funds has a gold fund. And by the way, I have probably investments in a bunch of those, full disclosure. And the other way is there's an exchange traded fund. This is probably the most direct way to speculate on the price of gold. There are a couple of exchange traded funds. The largest, the symbol is GLD for gold, and it tracks the price of gold on a daily basis. So gold now is trading at $1,277. We first mentioned it maybe 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
$1,200. It ran up to $1,245. It was back down to $1,203. I said, oh, wow, that was a quick run up. But it looked like gold was getting stronger, and now we are at $1,277.50.
All right, let's go buy a house. The rate of home ownership last year hit its lowest.
It'd be almost as good as gold.
Yeah, hit its lowest level on record. The high was 2004. There was a Zillow study, I think, looking at renters and how people just aren't that inclined to go buy a house. They like where they're renting. They don't have the down payment, and so they're just sitting still. And you are here to tell them to go buy something.
Well, you know, I sound like your grandmother or something like that telling you, oh, young man, young woman, buy a home. It's so out of fashion and so impractical in many ways for the generation that is today coming of home buying age. First of all, they come loaded with debt from college. Second of all, they have a lot of uncertainty about their jobs and their futures. And third of all, it's a different kind of life now where you don't work for a company for 30 or 40 years and get a gold watch. You're going to be switching around and maybe even moving to different cities. All of those are reasons that young people aren't buying homes. But if we have A, inflation, B, higher interest rates that come with inflation, then you're going to wish you had bought a home now and looked into all the programs that might make it affordable for you. Because rents are going to go up for sure if we have inflation. So you're not protected by not owning a home. And if you do have a home and you can build equity and home prices go up, then you're, even if you have to sell and move, you'll probably be okay. We had a once-in-a-lifetime experience with that real estate crash.
Yeah.
It has soured people who could be buying homes. And I think they will look back 10 or 15 years from now and say, oh, I wish I had gotten in.
All right. That's the advice from Terry Savage. Come down out of your high-rise apartment, get on the L, go out to the suburbs and buy a house. It doesn't have to be in the suburbs.
To buy a house. Just remember, property taxes are going up, too, with inflation.
All right. So Terry's got a column. Also, we're going to talk taxes a little bit later today with Ian. But Terry's got a column about health care and your tax returns. Are you just sitting down to do your taxes? We'll talk about that coming up. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's 1222. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Terry Savage joins us now. And she's got a column at terrysavage.com that has to do with filing your taxes and health care. So, Terry, this is not something new this year, right? I mean, since the Affordable Care Act, you've had to claim on your insurance return whether or not you're getting or whether or not you're insured, right? It's just one of the things you have to claim. And if not, then that's where you pay the penalty.
Exactly. Well, this is the point is it's getting more expensive. The penalties are getting more expensive. This is the third year. And I think a lot of people thought that things with Obamacare would change. As of now, really, basically nothing has changed. You know that I hate writing about tax stories. I thank you for TurboTax, and I think you'll do just fine if you're using a program like that. And this is a part of TurboTax. But this year, the penalties for not checking the box that says I have health insurance are going to be much larger than in the past. In the past, a lot of people thought it was just worthwhile not to pay. But now the coverage in 2016 penalty is $695 per adult and half as much for children, or 2.5% of your household adjusted gross income with a maximum of $2,085. And that's a lot of money for not having health insurance. And they're getting more sophisticated about checking up because there are these forms that you'll probably receive, whether you have health insurance through Medicare, Medicaid, through your corporation. They don't have to be filed with your return. But the fact is that the people who are insuring you file returns. And so if you lie, fill in the box, you're in trouble.
I want to interrupt you there. Tell me a little bit more about those forms because I got them. And I'm looking at them, and I kind of, because I'm a TurboTax guy, and I'm thinking, what do I do with these? And they never really asked me for anything. So you're just saying that was kind of something they sent me to say, we've sent it to the federal government, too.
Exactly. It's like it used to be a magnetic tape. I'm not sure exactly that they're actually sending magnetic tapes anymore. But the fact is, you know how if you don't report a dividend on your tax return, for sure they're going to catch it because all the companies that pay out dividends send your Social Security, and the computer does the checking. I mean, the IRS computers may be old and out of date, but they're checking on these basic things, and this has risen to the top. Everybody's afraid, oh, don't take the home office deduction. It might trigger an audit. But what will trigger a response from the IRS faster than almost anything now is not dealing appropriately with that box saying, do I have health insurance? Then, for those people who did have subsidies under the Obamacare program, there's a whole different set of issues because they could claw back your subsidy if you're earning. You know, in the beginning of the year, you estimate, oh, I think I'll earn $16,000 this year. And they say, okay, well, you're entitled to this subsidy. Well, you got a better job or something. They might claw back. Or if something happened and you lost your job, they might actually give you a refund if you've been paying too much for your health care premiums. So I just did this letter as a warning because it's not in everybody's mind. healthcare. The government is definitely into healthcare now, and whether it's about who pays for your care or how it's reimbursed, they're really into it on their tax return, and that's just a warning flag.
Okay.
So details at Terry Savage.
So yeah, terrysavage.com. You can read that. So I do TurboTax, and I know that all those things are being checked by computer. Back in the day, in what, the late 70s, or I don't know how long into the 80s, before this computer technology was in people's homes and things, how did they check? I mean, did they go over tax returns return by return, or was it just so much easier to cheat back then because they weren't looking at
them? In the olden days, my twin granddaughters would say.
Yeah.
In the olden days, yeah, they would pull returns and actually check. And now, though, anybody who pays anything to anybody has got to file a 1099.
Right, but the idea, the number, the percentage that they must have checked had to be very small back in the day.
Exactly. You probably had, although they had the fear was so great in those
right.
days, you probably had a better chance of getting away with stuff. However, now so much is electronic that it's just really smart to make sure that you pay all your taxes, you do it correctly. And I wrote this column sort of near the end of the tax season, but it's those last-minute things that you're not used to. You know, I used to write a column every year. Be sure and sign your tax return. Be sure and enclose your check. Be sure. That's not the way it works anymore.
No.
But the truth of the matter is the newer stuff that people don't really know so much about, haven't had decades of experience with, is what's going to trip you up. Healthcare is one of those.
I took my checks to
the
post office last night. Yeah?
Yeah. Next year, you know, now, by the way, one of the important points at the end of this column is if your healthcare expenses, including your premiums, exceed adjusted gross income, 7.5% of your adjusted gross income for those over 65 and 10% if you're under 65, then you can deduct those expenses. Next year, it's supposed to go to 10% for everyone. There's some hope that in tax reform, if it ever gets done, that it will stay at 7.5% for those over 65. But you know, they're going to get you is my message, so you might as well do it right.
Terry Savage, nice to talk to you. We'll check in again. Actually, I'm going to be off next week, so I'll check in with you again soon. So you'll be on maybe with John Hansen or someone next week.
Okay, perfect. Right. Have a good week.
You bet. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, 12:38 in the afternoon. We'll talk about emergency funds a little bit later in the program. But right now, Ian Schur is on a phone line from CNET. He joins us from time to time. Ian, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm awesome. Thank you very much. I was just talking to Terry Savage in the last half hour a little bit about taxes, and I filed my taxes a few weeks ago, but actually wrote the checks yesterday and dropped them into the mail and mailed them away. But one of the things on CNET, and I remember this was a big issue, was it last year, Ian, or a couple, where some state filing returns were delayed because there were so many hackers taking people's accounts and trying to get their refunds. I mean, do you recall was something extraordinary a couple years ago?
It's been extraordinary for quite a while. My memory is that for the most part, they have kept tax filings going, but they've extended it sometimes because the system's overloaded. And then other times also, like this year, the 15th lands on a weekend, and
right.
So they extend it to, I believe, the 18th this year. But the bottom line is that, for example, in 2013, criminals attempted to steal $30 billion in tax refunds. And when you consider the average refund to that $2,900, that is easy, instant profit if they can do it.
Okay, how does it work? Are they going and seeking out individual filers? Are they buying in bulk? Or what's the process here?
Yeah, it's actually devilishly simple. So you know that on the what we call the dark web, where all the bad guys hang out and share information.
Sure, it's right on Friday nights.
There's already stuff like Social Security numbers and your bank account information. All of that's already there. So all they have to do is buy a database of all this stuff. They know most of the information about you. They just fake everything else, send it in. And, you know, the IRS has been seeing the number of people who work for it decline, and they've been facing budget cuts. And so as a result, they get the refund check before you do. And that's the worst part, is that you can't file a refund twice. So once they do it, you're kind of screwed.
So they're not really filing anything that has to do with my actual return. They're filing completely bogus returns.
No, they don't know returns. What your W-2 is. All they know is that they probably have your Social Security number. They know where you live. They know your name. They know a lot of information about you. And so they're just filing willy-nilly. And, you know, it takes them very little time to do it. and there's a potential huge profit out of it. And that's why this problem still exists.
All right. So I know that how do you stop it? I mean, I know they're doing something kind of interesting in Alabama, but I don't know. When's the last time Alabama led the country in something other than football? Are they the leaders here in fighting this?
I'm not going to besmirch Alabama, but it's actually really fascinating. What they're doing is that they are taking they're basically requiring that you take a photo of your driver's license. And it's really smart because while the hackers may have a lot of stuff about you, they don't actually have a copy of your real driver's license. So that could help. Other ones, like, I don't know, you probably dealt with the PIN at this point where you have to file with a special digital PIN. That was an attempt to stop some of the stuff, and it's worked to a degree. But this is part of the escalating battle, right? We come up with a better mousetrap, they build a better mouse. And so it's just going to keep going like this.
All right. Well, I did learn that then. I guess for some reason I thought it was in one way or another connected to my actual return, but it has nothing to do with that. It's just the data they can get any which way, any time.
Yeah, they could. Here's one way they can get your return is that the, you know, hackers are especially very good at phishing, right, where they send you an email that makes you think that it's got information that's important, but in fact is carrying a virus or malware. And so it's very popular now to send these around. And once they've got access to your computer, they can get everything. And I don't know about you, but a lot of people I know who I end up, you know, I fix computers for friends and family. A lot of them have their tax returns from TurboTax or whatever just sitting on their desktop. And so that way the hackers can easily get that information, but they're rarely looking for it.
Okay.
When they're trying to steal your, get into your computer, they're usually looking for other stuff.
Note to self, move tax returns on my computer. By the way, I just got several texts from Alabama. I'll try to defend you as best I can, but you said it, not me.
Right.
While we're talking about hackers, what happened in Dallas with the emergency sirens?
You know, that is one of those things. So over the weekend, hackers are believed to have broken into the emergency system in Dallas, which I don't know about what it's like in Chicago, but here in San Francisco, we have a siren system that they test every week, and you can barely understand it, but you hear the siren and you realize that there's something going on. So they hacked into there are 156 of them in Dallas. They hacked into them and set them off overnight, which is, of course, not a very good thing for most people trying to sleep.
Right.
And they had to shut down the system.
And so then if there were real emergencies, you wouldn't have heard. I mean, I know I've got a group of friends who are, this is their fear, that hackers are going to sort of take over the infrastructure or things like that, and that's how they're going to end up really inflicting a blow. And I would imagine those friends of mine who are worried about that have got to be pretty upset about this.
Yeah, I believe it. And the thing is, we've written on CNET many times, that is one of the kind of really scary scenarios that hacking experts bring up, is that our infrastructure especially is not very well protected. As we've learned many times over now, the government is not very good at cybersecurity when it comes to people who are not the security agencies. And so it's become a real problem. And I mean, all you have to do is look at places like Iran, where we were able to send in a virus that slowed down their nuclear program just by sending a little USB stick.
Yeah.
Right? And so this stuff could have wide ranging consequences. And what's really tough is that it's been run chronicled now many times. People often aren't willing to fund bond measures to fund fixing
to increase it, because
as a result,
it's just not sexy.
That are bad.
All right, we've got less than a minute, but I'm conflicted about this one. I've never really believed the airlines when they told me it wasn't safe for me to use my cell phone on the plane. I don't know. They're the experts. Okay. But I know there was a movement at the FCC to say, oh, no, we're going to make it so you can use your phone. Now the new chairman of the FCC says, no, we're not. We're going to back off on that. I don't really want the person next to me talking, but it seems like the chairman's chief reason is because he doesn't want the person next to him talking either. I don't think that's what the FCC is supposed to be ruling on.
It's a really weird choice, right? Like, if you're thinking about, you know, it seems a little short-sighted, right? I'm not going to argue against him fully, but, you know, there are many examples where having a cell phone in flight is valuable. I think the best example is Flight 93 in 9/11,
sure,
where family members were able to call one another right before everything happened. And so there are times when having a cell phone could be valuable. But I know for sure when I first saw the news in 2013 that they were considering this, I slapped my forehead and thought, oh, my God, this is just another thing to make my flight worse.
I know, but it's not up to the FCC, right, to make my flight comfortable. They're supposed to be worried more about. I thought this was supposed to be a safety issue for them, not a courtesy issue.
Yes, and absolutely. And the thing is, we have the technology now. A lot of the reasons that they weren't allowing cell phones on, outside of airplane mode on airplanes was that there's a possibility that the radio signals could cause troubles. And so now that we've gotten really good at doing Wi-Fi on the plane, and we have satellite on our planes, they now could install cellular antennas that collect that information and don't flummox any of the other systems. And so it's possible to be done. They're just, it seems as though the FCC just doesn't feel like we should.
Ian Scherer, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I hope you'll follow me on Twitter, at Steve Bertrand, or on Facebook as well. I have a public page there, and follow me there. We'll keep you updated. We often put links to different stories we're talking about on the program, so it's a nice way for me to stay in touch with you, and I appreciate that. All right, what's your rainy day fund look like? Do you have one? Do you have an emergency fund? On the phone line, Scott Magnuson, the Managing Director and Financial Advisor at Morgan Stanley in Oak Brook, joins us. Scott, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Good evening. Good afternoon, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. You know, and I hear about this emergency fund or the rainy day fund, and what my first reaction is, I'm trying to find a survey, but it seems like a lot of people, are kind of living paycheck to paycheck or just beyond. They don't really have the funds to save up for an emergency that may or may not come. What's the value here, and why should someone who's kind of scraping by try to put a little bit aside for an emergency one day?
Well, that's a great question, Steve. What many people do is they're involved in their retirement plan at work and their 401k, or they might be starting college funds for their kids, but they've skipped the most important step, and that is having that rainy day or emergency fund. Because if you don't have an emergency fund and something comes up, you are going to have to disturb those long-term investment
right.
plans you've built, and there can be typically taxes and penalties. So one of the first things you want to do when you start to build a long-term financial plan is, number one, get proper insurance planning. Make sure you have the proper life and auto and homeowners and health insurance and liability insurance. And then secondly, build that 3 to 6 month living expense emergency fund. So when things come about, you don't have to disturb your long-term plans.
Okay, so right. So that's money that I'm not putting in my 401k. I don't want to disturb my 401k or pay penalties there. Are you saying then that this 3 to 6 months, that's a big chunk. That should be in cash, or where should that money be?
Yeah, it should be in something that's very liquid, an FDIC-insured savings account, a money market fund, something that doesn't fluctuate with the market, whether it be stock or bond market, something that you can tap or maybe as easily as write a check, you can draw those funds.
Well, what percentage of us do you think actually have 3 to 6 months in payment put aside in an emergency fund? I'm going low single digits here, Scott.
Probably so. I mean, my clients, 100% of them do, because
yeah.
I won't start a plan for them until they have that. But you're right. Many, many people do not. So just like you, many people, it's easy to build a retirement plan if it's taken out of your paycheck monthly. In many cases, some of you might want to do that, where you actually have X amount of your money out of your paycheck going to a separate segregated account where you build that money up. And then that money is off limits unless it's one of those emergencies arises.
Okay, so I'm just thinking from your standpoint, then you're a financial advisor. You're the guy who wants to, I'm going to be happy when I see my 401k grow, when I see my savings grow. If I see this just chunk out there, it's got to be a tough sell sometimes to people, because I want that money earning more dividend income or interest income or, in equity income than just sitting there waiting for my chimney to fall in.
Right. Well, it is. But in the scheme of things, the penalties and taxes can be much more hurtful if you don't. A couple other things you could do. Some people will get a line of credit, home equity line of credit against their house, where they can draw money against that in an emergency at a very low interest rate. Many people will just keep good credit. They'll use their credit card and they'll get to make sure they have a good line of credit on their credit card, so they can use that card temporarily until they can go access those funds that maybe are earning a little bit more. So there are some things you can do rather than just leaving in a bank account. But for my clients, I prefer to have a chunk of money just sitting there in case those emergencies arise. And they arise quite often.
All right, we're talking to Scott Magnuson. He's the Managing Director, Financial Advisor at Morgan Stanley in Oak Brook. Okay, I'm sitting on your office chair. You're talking to me, and you're telling me it's a little tough love. Like, you're not going to work for me if I don't put some money away for an emergency fund?
basically, yes, because it's going to disturb my long-term plans for you for other things. So,
well, and that's the way to think of it, isn't it? That it's not, it shouldn't be considered as something separate, or I've been describing it as something over there. It's really not. It's part of a more healthy whole.
Exactly right. I mean, when you sit down with someone the first time, and you're basically there's three things I do when I meet a new client the first time. And the first thing is, number one, I make sure they got proper insurance planning, because a lot of those emergencies that arise, if you've done proper insurance planning, it will take care of itself. So the proper amount of life insurance, for instance, for you and your spouse, and you know, if you have children, certainly you need a little bit more. And whether it be term or whole life or universal life, sitting down with that, you know, life insurance agent, making sure you got auto insurance, homeowners renter's insurance, very important. Health insurance, you know, obviously, whether you be Obamacare or something you have to work, you want to make sure you've got something in there to take care of you. And then liability insurance, you know, an umbrella policy in case someone slips on your sidewalk. And then as you get closer to retirement, maybe even long-term care insurance. So those are all things you need to address first before you even begin an investment plan.
You know, and I think, then, too, there's value. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just the fact that it's good to have it aside, because once you're faced with some sort of emergency, you might always not be thinking so clearly. You might rush yourself into a decision that's really going to have a long-term cost.
Exactly right. And that's why if you think about it, when you're not in an emergency situation, you're likely to make better sound decisions. Then, of course, the second thing is making sure you have that 3 to 6 month living expenses. That's the second thing we make sure we do in a very safe place that's segregated from any kind of long-term retirement planning or college planning. And then lastly, you got to basically have your things organized. I mean, I always tell people, where are your documents? Where's your will? Where's your trust? Where are those homeowners policies? Where's the title for your car? Where's your Social Security card, your birth certificates, you know, all those, a list of all your passwords. Those things need to be in a place where some loved one can grab at them and get access to them in case you're in a, you know, some kind of medical emergency or, you know, an accident or something where you can't get that information to them.
Scott Magnuson from Morgan Stanley Oakbrook. Great to talk to you. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
No problem. Happy to be here.